This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're listening to The Matt McNeil Show, and I am not Matt McNeil. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in. Matt's on vacation. We got Brett on the board today, and we're just out here kind of in the more open, up kind of higher on a hill. Man, was it windy coming from my car into the building. My door of my car almost got blown off. We're not catching the really bad weather going on to the north of us and to the south of us. So it, tornadoes are never fun. And there was some really bad weather down in Missouri. A significant tornado tore through southeastern Missouri on Wednesday morning, killing multiple people and leaving widespread destruction as authorities warned of more twisters. The Missouri State Highway Patrol sent troopers to Bollinger County to assist multiple local agencies in search and recovery efforts after a tornado in the Glen Allen area. Governor Mike Parson posted an aerial picture of the devastation and in Bollinger County, saying that fatalities have been confirmed and others have been injured. And this is what is really scary. The tornado traversed rural Bollinger County south of St. Louis at a speed of about 45 miles an hour for about 15 minutes, sometime between 3:30 and 4 a.m. It was significant given how much damage it caused, Witten said. It's going to be on the high end. Unfortunately, it looks serious and bad. There are at least 4 weather-related deaths in or around Bollinger County. And this is a news report written, I believe, this morning. So always bad to hear that kind of thing happening. Up to the north, they got dumped on with a lot of snow. But immediately to the east, we had an incredible thing happen last night in Wisconsin. So it's very exciting. It's been 15 years since the Supreme Court in Wisconsin has been at all reasonable. They have been doing scary things in Wisconsin, especially over the last year or less. Right now, you cannot get an abortion. You can't get any kind of abortion care. I heard a story of one woman whose daughter is married and just got pregnant and was wanting to move to Wisconsin and decided not to because she's afraid, what if something went wrong in my pregnancy? Doctors don't want to practice in Wisconsin because they could get in trouble for providing health care for pregnant women. It's basically they brought back an 1849 abortion ban after the Dobbs decision was made. So we need to clean it up. And now we're on our way to doing that. In Wisconsin, the Supreme Court really can make some changes. So the way – also, another thing about Wisconsin, the reason that the Republicans have been able to do all this stuff is because of the gerrymandering. So much of the vote goes towards Democrats in the state, yet 2/3 in both their House and Senate is red. And they have – 8 congressional districts, 6 are Republicans. It does not reflect the electorate. And last night especially proves it. Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz won with 55.5% of the vote over former Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly, who got 44.5. So that's an 11-point margin. Dan Kelly is a MAGAT. He's a member of the Federalist Society, as are all of the Republican Supreme Court justices for the United States. The Federalist Society has been working on inserting people into the judicial system, both statewide and nationally. And Dan Kelly, I have a clip of Dan Kelly here. If I can find it. This is pretty incredible. This is Dan Kelly after he found out that he lost. Normally this would be a concession speech time, but here's what he had to say.
That in a circumstance like this, I would be able to concede to a worthy opponent. But I do not have a worthy opponent to which I can concede. This was the most deeply deceitful, dishonorable, despicable campaign I have ever seen run for the courts. It was truly beneath contempt.
And, of course, that's all projection. The reason it was a contemptible race is because of him. He was absolutely vile throughout the whole campaign. And she was speaking to the people and offering up to support what the people of Wisconsin want in an overwhelming majority. There was video of in Eau Claire University. I saw somebody walking with their camera along the line of college kids waiting to vote. And it was pretty unbelievable. It's hard to count, but I would say that it was more than 1,000 because, you know, she's walking by 10 people pretty quick. It took like a full, 60 seconds to walk kind of fast along the whole length, going in and out of different rooms and around corners. And there was an awful lot of kids waiting to vote. This is why the Republicans want to raise the voting age to 21. It's only going to buy them about 3 years, but they know that Gen Z is coming after them and coming hard. Also in Wisconsin, of course, the Dobbs decision was a big part of it because Wisconsin then immediately completely banned abortions in the state. Minnesota had to figure out how to take all the Wisconsinites into Minnesota who need reproductive care. The numbers in Wisconsin are pretty mind-blowing. In Ozaukee County, some of these names are just as hard as Minnesota names. So it's like I've heard of Waukesha before because it's the home of the Shah, right? Ozaukee, a lot of Native American names that are spelled really weird. Ozaukee County got 52. So this is a very red district. Ozaukee County, the vile Republican, Dan Kelly, got 52% of the vote. That's just a little over half. In 2020 and 2016, Trump got 55% of the vote. But in 2012, Romney got 64.6% of the vote. So in about 10 years, Ozaukee County used to get 64.5% of the Republican vote, and now they get just barely above 50. The same is true for Waukesha. They got the Republican got 58 last night. Trump got 60, both in 20 and 16, and then 66.8 went to Romney in 2012. Trump carried Brown County, Allegheny County, and Winnebago County, and all three of them went for the Democrat last night. Dane County, 82% went for the Democrat last night. Now, that was already a blue district. It encases Madison, the city of Madison. And Biden got 75% of the vote in Dane County. So in 2.5 years, we've raised it from 75 to 82%. Now, this means that the voter turnout in Wisconsin was absolutely mind-blowing, just like it was in 2022 and 2020 and 2018. We hear polls that scare us all the time, but the polls really can't get at the Gen Z people. You've heard me talk about this before, because every time there's an election over the last year, even more so over the last year, it's been mind-blowing. What happened in Kansas last summer, and now what's happening in Wisconsin. And the trend that it sets is that, you know, these Gen Z people, they're really passionate about this stuff because it's threatening their lives. If you're a young woman, if you're a Gen Z woman, you don't want to live in Wisconsin until they change the reproductive care laws. If you're a doctor, you don't want to practice in Wisconsin until they change the reproductive health care laws. And now the Senate switched from being overran by far-right kind of Republicans, and now it's got a majority of Democrats. And they're pretty liberal. And the Supreme Court has a lot of power in Wisconsin. They can overturn the abortion ban. They can demand the gerrymandered lines get redrawn. Those two things alone. They can make changes in the freedom to vote, which is also a mess in Wisconsin. Republicans have been cheating in order to win, because that's the only way they can win. And they've been cheating real hard in Wisconsin. We're going to take a short break, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about Wisconsin, because this is really an incredible thing, an absolutely incredible thing, and it can have ramifications nationally as well. We'll talk about that when we come back from a short break. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. We'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in for the Matt McNeil Show. And like every Wednesday on the Matt McNeil Show, we will have Jeff Stein calling in at 3:30 in about 8 minutes. And we'll be talking to him about national presidential stuff. It's kind of a slow week as far as, you know, that is going. So I'm not sure what we're going to talk about.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. When I first started producing at AM 950, we used to have weeks like that. Or it would be,
yeah.
What do you want to talk about today?
Yeah.
That hasn't been the case ever since about the middle of 2015.
I know. I have a huge lineup of stuff to talk about. I know I'm not going to get to all of it today. It's what happened when Trump became president. It did turn out as bad as everyone thought, you know? It's just that we've been the frog slowly boiling in the slowly changing temperature of the water instead of being thrown into the boiling water, you know? So now we're acclimated to it, and that's scary enough, you know? And that's another thing I think is different between our generation, you and I are not even really in the same generation, but both our generations – compared to like the Gen Z generation, where, you know, this has been a huge part of their life. You know, I mean, Eve was what, 11 or 12 when Trump became president, and of course, when you're that age, you don't pay as much attention. You know, you're just listening to music and stuff, and at least that's what I was just listening to music and trying to talk to girls and failing. Is all I was doing at that age. And so now they're here and they see what's going on and they're fixing it. Whereas, you know, some of us are just like, oh my God, what just happened? We're still just standing up out of the dirt, you know, like the storm just blew over us and we haven't had time to get our wits about us again yet. So, as you know, if you listen and heard me on this show, I'm always very optimistic, and the predictions that I've been making, I can't take credit for predicting them myself. I've listened to really good information from other people who do a lot of research, and I just choose what kind of research I think is going to be the most accurate, and it has been. We can't really go by our old-fashioned polling and all of that stuff, so you know, things have been getting better and better. It started immediately after Trump was elected. I mean, he was ruining the world. But younger people were saying, okay, I got to vote. So that's a big difference. Gen Z, they see their whole lives, it has been important to vote because the world can get scary fast if you don't. And like I said, that's what happened in Wisconsin. And we were going to talk about the national ramifications of Wisconsin. If you remember, in 2020, the Wisconsin Supreme Court narrowly rejected an attempt by former President Donald Trump to overturn the results of the presidential election. The court could see a similar challenge in 2024. But now it's going to be ran by Democrats instead of Republicans. Even though it was ran by Republicans, it was rejected, but it was very narrowly rejected. Trump was almost successful in turning over the state of Wisconsin to go for him instead of Biden. And if he would have been successful at that, Trump could have won the presidency again in 2020. Following the 2020 elections, Dan Kelly, the horrible person that you heard talk at the top of the hour, who lost the election last night, he was hired by the Wisconsin GOP to advise on a plan to have a group of Republicans falsely claim to be electors. We've been hearing a lot about that story over the last couple years. The plan failed, and Wisconsin's 10 Democratic electors voted for Joe Biden, reflecting the popular vote in the state. So if you remember, this guy Dan Kelly, he was kind of in charge of getting the fake electors going. And there are people going to jail. Some of those fake electors are going to jail. And what they were going to do was send their own electors. They were just going to choose their own electors, and they were going to go and report that Wisconsin went for Trump. A big lie. They almost were successful. So that's how important Wisconsin can be. It's going to be really difficult to win the presidential election without Wisconsin. Wisconsin's a battleground state, as they call it. It's a very important state in presidential elections. And what if Dan Kelly would have won last night and then Trump did the same thing in 2024 and Dan Kelly was on the Supreme Court? They probably would not narrowly reject the attempt by Trump. And then what happens? So their plan is no longer working, as we could see in New York when Trump, you know, did not have people there protesting for him. And they ran Marjorie Taylor Greene out of town. She was trying to... You know, I think she fantasized about having a bunch of protesters there, and she was yelling through a bullhorn, and they were all going to follow her into hell. And instead, they all yelled at her and told her to get the frig out, because they're all New Yorkers, so they use the word frig. Get the frig out. And she did. She ran to her car. She spoke for, I don't know, 90 seconds, and then ran to her car with security and some policemen were trying to help her. I think she fell down once, and then she got in her car and hightailed it out of town. So, yeah, it's not going well for the Republican Party anymore. They brought it on, you know. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June, A 1849 law banning abortion went back into effect in Wisconsin. Abortion quickly emerged as a top issue in this race, with voters across the state mobilizing around the question of abortion access. That's going to happen all over and over again because it's a very, very important issue, and people are going to be voting on that exact issue. It happened again last night in Wisconsin. Elections are going extremely well, and I don't see that changing. the candidates that the Republicans have for president, I don't see any of them working out very well for them. But hey, we got to get ready for Jeff Stein, right? So we should take a break. Is that right, Brett? Should we take a break right now?
Yeah, it's almost time for Jeff Stein for the Wednesday visit. You are correct.
All right, we'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk to Jeff Stein. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in on the Matt McNeil Show. We'll be right back. National and presidential expert, noted author. You can find his books at Next Chapter Booksellers, totallyiowa.com. You can also find him at the Iowa Business Report and the Iowa Politics Report. How you doing, Jeff?
I am well. Look at that. I even still get the theme music. It's even better than when Matt is here.
Yeah, it was still him singing, though.
Well, you know, I don't even want to think about how many he had before he pulled up the karaoke machine on that one. But good to talk to you again.
Yeah. Nice to talk to you, too. It seems like a slow news week. I don't know what to talk about.
The twins.
Yeah. Let's just talk about the twins for a half an hour. So people are talking about the strength of the indictment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still drunk from celebrating yesterday on arraignment day. Yeah, people are talking about the strength of the indictment. My opinion is that I don't think he would have brought the indictment if it wasn't very strong. And I've heard some experts who kind of say that as well. But there are also people who are saying, I don't know if this is going to even go to court, or go to trial. What do you think about that?
Well, I've not reviewed it. I am a lawyer, but I've not reviewed it. The way the process works is the prosecutor did not really bring the indictment. The grand jury voted to indict. And that's a key distinction. Now, could Mr. Bragg have stuck with his initial interpretation and not move forward? Sure. Could he move to dismiss? Sure. But the reason a prosecutor brings material to a grand jury is to insulate herself or himself from bias.
Right.
Now, having just said that, that's a kind of idealistic view, because the way the grand jury works is the prosecutor presents evidence. They don't present a defense.
Mm-hmm.
You can invite the targeted party. And in fact, Mr. Trump was, quote unquote, invited to participate. Well, 99% of the time, the person who is the target does not participate because you don't want to give the prosecution a hint as to what the defense would be. So basically, it's a matter of people in a grand jury hearing evidence in the light most favorable for the prosecution and then deciding if it's enough to bring a charge.
Right.
And they're going by the legal interpretation of the prosecution, et cetera. So the concept that there was an indictment is not a shock because of how the system's set up. It'd be the same thing if it was Hennepin County and Matt McNeil was the defendant. The bottom line is, as long as you've got a grand jury situation, it's not a surprise that there's an indictment. Where it goes from here is the interesting part. You know, will there be motions to dismiss? Sure. Will there be motions to force the judge to recuse himself because of a conflict? Of course. I mean, there are a whole host of things that you do in this situation. Now, I did a commentary the other day where once it was announced, I said it was not a cause for celebration, and I don't care who you are, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of political spectrum, because I was hearing people on the right saying, well, this guarantees his reelection, et cetera, et cetera. Here's why it's not, to me, a cause for celebration, because either someone who 74 million Americans less than 3 years ago said should be the leader of the free world for another 4 years, if he did things that are felonious or criminal in nature, that's letting those 74 million people down. They may become disillusioned with the system. They may never come back in, and that would be tragic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Similarly, if it is as thin a case as many have asserted, many on all sides have asserted, well, then that's also a sad day, because it means that we have taken a fundamental premise of our society, the rule of law, and it has become political. Mm-hmm. So to me, you know, it's a spectacle, and I don't care how it comes out. In one respect, I don't have a dog in the fight, but it raises a lot of questions, and let's just see it play out, because reality is, Todd, until yesterday, nobody knew what the charges were until it was unsealed.
Right.
Nobody really knows what the evidence is. We've heard all sorts of folks talk about the evidence, but it was a closed, by definition, grand jury is a closed situation. We don't know what's really out there.
Right.
And so for anyone to offer anything other than acknowledgement that there has been an appearance in court, you know, it's all speculation.
Yeah, it's kind of turned out to be less of a spectacle than I think a lot of people were anticipating. Like we said, no. Marjorie Taylor Greene tried to make a big event happen, and it just didn't happen. And people didn't. There were more reporters than protesters or Trump supporters, and people didn't line the streets. Trump didn't talk to the camera when he walked into the courtroom, and then cameras weren't allowed in there. So it was kind of a non-event in a way, and then it's not going to be taken up again until December. So in some ways the spectacle of it is going to, I suppose, disappoint some people, but I think it's also going to tamp down some of the negative effects like that you were mentioning, and mm-hmm. other negative effects that might happen. It's just kind of looking like, it might be possible that Trump is kind of fizzling out. So I had a question, though, that I think I wonder about, and I think everybody wonders about, and you would know this. When the grand jury – so there was 34 counts, and are those presented as all 34 counts sort of individually to the grand jury, and then they say yes for number one and no for number two and yes for number three, or does the jury itself kind of build those 34 counts?
It's a great question, Todd, and it's really kind of a combination, because what the prosecution does is set out facts, or what they are asserting are facts with evidence. And then they say, here's what the law is. And now apply the facts to that law to see if there is a valid charge. And so it's not quite this, it's not like here's a menu and necessarily checking all the boxes. Mm-hmm. But realistically, the way it was laid out to make them each individual, each individual line on a form is an individual count. That was something presented by the prosecution that the grand jury then agreed with. That's okay. The short of it. And this is what people get very excited about, too, the anti-Trump folks saying 34, however many it is, 34 felonies. How many of them are tied to the same piece of paper?
Right. Yeah.
And so by the time you combine all of these things, it's no different than in a criminal case. If there are three or four charges and someone is convicted of three or four charges, but they all came out of the same set of facts, any sentences are often running concurrently, meaning at the same time as opposed to consecutively. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it was, you know, Matt McNeil who had 34 felonies, but they all had to do with the same course of action, the same set of facts, there's going to be one punishment. And it wouldn't be any different if it's a former president of the United States.
Right. So what is the process then? I also quite kind of didn't quite understand. So December is pretty far off. And I imagine, you know, it's the defense has to get their defense together. But then they go to court on December 4th, but they don't go to trial until – if they go to trial – until January. So is December 4th when we would find out whether or not it's going to go to trial?
There's a lot that can happen between now and then. Essentially what they do is, here's your arraignment. All right, here are your charges. So they've set a trial date for January, and then you count back X number of weeks for what's known as a pretrial conference. And this is standard in all jurisdictions in one form or another. So the idea is that they make sure that all pending motions have been resolved, that there's no dispute about evidence, that, and usually in a normal criminal case, the judge would encourage the parties to reach a resolution of some kind so they don't have to waste the time of a trial. And so the December date is, in essence, the pretrial conference for a trial in January. Now, let's say the trial, for whatever reason, gets moved 90 days later. Then that December pretrial conference gets moved to be in close proximity with the new trial date. Mm-hmm. But what will happen between now and then, because that's all they have set right now. He's been arraigned. Here's a trial date. We always have a pretrial conference before trial. There it is. Yep. But between now and then, you're going to have, Todd, all of these motions. Is it going to be a motion to dismiss because of statute of limitations? A motion to dismiss because it's not really a felony because there is no federal crime? The first thing, and then it could be a motion for change of venue out of that jurisdiction, or at the very least, asking the judge to recuse himself. What may come.
And it sounds like all of those things are going to happen. It sounds like.
Oh, the absolutely.
Defense, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, the lawyers are working by the hour.
Yeah.
And it's a flip. As a lawyer, that's a flip statement. But the reality is all of those, you know, those are the defenses. The judge is biased. There's a statute of limitations issue. There's no federal charge that could be bootstrapped to make this a state felony. All of those things. But the first thing that they're going to wind up filing, maybe contemporaneous, but is something called an application for bill of particulars. And what that means, that's a legal pleading that you file that says the indictment, the charging statement is not specific enough for Trump to prepare a defense. So, okay. For example, in this particular situation, they're saying that he falsified these documents to cover up a federal crime, but they have not identified what the federal crime is.
Right.
It could be tax laws. It could be election laws. And when Alvin Bragg was asked yesterday, why is the federal crime not mentioned? He said, I don't have to reveal that yet.
Yeah.
Well, he may not for the indictment, but he sure is going to have to in the bill of particulars, or else you're the Trump team saying, we don't even know what the federal crime is. And the law, the rules of criminal procedure would not allow that. This is the part where, and I don't want to make too much of this, but the fact that that federal crime was not mentioned in the indictment, as an independent observer, that would concern me about the propriety of the indictment. Because does it mean the grand jury had no idea what the federal crime was? They just took on faith there was a federal crime? In which case, that lends support for the thing being dismissed because of the fact nobody has actually approved or gone along with the fact that there was a federal crime.
Right. I heard a little bit about that last night, and I heard one expert say that sometimes that's done because you don't want to strap yourself to something prematurely if you are the prosecutor. You have a little bit of room to move and take your time to think about, you know, what's going to happen in the next step. So sometimes that is done on purpose. Is that correct?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it is correct that you don't want to show your cards too soon if you're the prosecutor.
Right.
But when the whole premise of the state felony is that it was to cover up a federal crime, what's the federal crime? Because if you're the defendant in this case, it's a very different defense if you say it is an election law as opposed to tax law.
Right.
And so you have to ultimately be told enough. So here's where the conspiracy theory comes in, if you're primed for that. The conspiracy theory is that Bragg knew he could get an indictment. I'm so sick of hearing you can indict a ham sandwich. But the idea is right. he could get the indictment.
Yeah.
And that clears the way for Atlanta.
Yeah.
For whoever's handling the document case. In other words, somebody had to go first.
Yeah.
And kind of break the ice that Trump could be indicted.
Exactly.
This could be the sacrificial lamb case. This could be the straw man case.
Right.
This could be the case where they filed it. Now the dam has been breached. They don't care. They'll never pursue this if there is an indictment somewhere else, because now we're all used to seeing it.
Right.
And again, is that, I don't know, Todd, is that deep conspiracy thinking?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't think so at all. I don't think it's conspiracy thinking. I think it's fairly reasonable, because also, you know, and if that does happen that way, and if that is correct, then some of these other things, like the, you know, some of the more obvious things, like, say, the classified documents at Mar-a-Lardo is what we're calling it here now. If that's the case, then people are going to just kind of forget about this one, you know, by the time everyone's talking about that one.
Well, and again, that's the thing where we have never had – I mean, you know, this is not a news alert. Everyone listening knows this. Prior to this situation, there had never been a criminal indictment of a sitting or former president.
Right.
Including Nixon. Okay?
Right.
So now that we have that, okay, the China's broken, if you will. Right?
Yeah.
All right. So now does that take – some of the subconscious limitation off of these individuals?
Yeah,
I don't think that's the case with the prosecutors. The prosecutors, if they are doing their job, they're ferreting out what they think is the truth and presenting it to a judge or to a grand jury.
Right.
So it's not going to necessarily sway a prosecutor.
Right.
Would it sway a grand juror?
Right. Yeah.
That may be part of it.
Well, say, we need to take a short break, and then we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more in that line of things. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We've got Jeff Stein on the line during the Matt McNeil Show. I'm Todd Mickelson sitting in for him. We'll be right back.
You're just another recovering heart. I wasn't even going to try.
AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, back in the saddle, sitting in for Matt McNeil on the Matt McNeil Show. We've got Jeff Stein on the line, and I'm sure you can figure out what we're talking about if you haven't heard yet. So, Jeff, you said, you know, we've never had a former or sitting president indicted. We have had a sitting vice president indicted and actually, you know, convicted. And he was doing the same thing Trump does. He was doing the whole, you know, this is a witch hunt. This is a political thing. I didn't do anything wrong, and all this stuff. And he had a lot of followers doing the same thing. It was very much like going. I saw a video of somebody had a microphone on the street talking to people, and they were all saying, "No, he's a great guy. They're doing this to him." You know, they're weaponizing the government. This is all, you know, exactly the same thing as like taking a microphone to a Trump rally back in 1973, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that has any, you know, can we use anything we learned from that in this thing with Trump?
Not a lot, because Spiro Agnew was a mercurial figure. He was the pit bull for the Nixon administration against the media. I mean, this is where the fake news thing started.
Yeah.
Right. Was
nattering
nabobs of negativism. I know of this. I was young when it happened. But Agnew took off after the media in Des Moines, Iowa. It was the first of four speeches that week. And that's not where he said nattering nabobs of negativism, but which is still hard to say. That was a Pat Buchanan line. I don't know if you knew that, but that was Buchanan.
I've never even heard that line before. You
oh, yeah.
You know
yeah,
more about
yeah.
it than I do.
He look it up, because he could say it. I can't really say it. But that right. that was the whole idea about these privileged men in their offices in New York who decides what the news is. And it's almost humorous when you see that
it's projection.
It's the same line, again today. The distinction to me is that this was a sitting vice president who, for all the bluster, crawled into court suddenly, entered a plea of nolo contendere, and was out of office.
Yeah.
Because obviously there was something there.
Right.
Now, that's different than someone with the reputation of bravado like Trump. Now, granted, Marylanders would say that Agnew had a pretty good opinion of himself, but Trump is a whole different level.
Yeah.
Plus, he's running. And so he's out of office presently, but running. So it's the middle of a political campaign.
Yeah.
And
it makes it even more unprecedented.
You're right. But it's an interesting thing for people to remember. And I'm so glad you brought it up. It's an interesting thing to remember that just because they got voted in through the Electoral College does not make them off limits. And again, just ask Spiro Agnew.
Right. Yeah. Although Nixon didn't seem to learn from it, because after he got pardoned, he seemed to have in his head that it's not wrong if the president does it. You know, he said that in an interview. If the president does it, it's not illegal. And that's kind of what Trump is saying now.
Certainly with regard to the confidential documents, that's been basically, as one of the aides was carrying a banker's box from Staples out of the Oval Office, he just waved his arm and said, "I hereby declassify you."
Yeah.
Well, there's probably a little more of a process that you would need on that, other than, well, in my mind, I thought I was going to do it, and so if they didn't hear me when I said it, I guess that's their fault.
Right, and he's incriminated himself in so many different directions on that case from what he has said publicly. One thing I also want to get in before we have to go here, the thing – so he was kind of reprimanded a little bit about talking about the judge and his family. He did a Truth Social tweet, whatever you call it, saying that, the judge's daughter worked for Kamala Harris and the judge hates me and his wife hates me and all this stuff. And then basically the judge yesterday told him, don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to put a gag order on you now, but don't do it again. And then the first thing he did was flew down to Mar-a-Lago and tried to have a public speech and said all those things all over again. Do you see anything developing with that?
Well, the problem was, and I'm not sure I have this exactly right, but the judge said, I am admonishing you from using your social media platform to make comments about the case.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't use his social media platform. He had a nationwide address.
Yeah.
Well, that's the issue with Mr. Trump and subtlety.
Yeah.
The judge saw bad behavior on social media, so he said, don't do that on social media. And so the response was, I'll just have a big old speech.
Yeah, it's like he's got the mentality of a mob boss who knows how to, never have an email out there, never have a piece of paper out there, so he covers his butt. Can we say that, Brett? I think we can say butt.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Brett would know, because he's got to get the dump button for McNeil all the time. But what it comes down to is, and it's the same thing Matt and I talk about, who has ever stopped him before?
Yeah, right.
No one. And I don't know that this is going to do it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and
he's going to have a bad year, though. It seems like something's going to stop him before the year's up.
It might. But if he was listening to this show, and I know he listens regularly, have someone else do the attacks.
Right.
Because you're now under bond provisions in a criminal case, and that doesn't end well.
Yes. Thank you so much for being on with us, Jeff. We have to run. Find Jeff's books at Next Chapter Booksellers, and also go see him on totallyiowa.com, the Iowa Business Report, and the Iowa Politics Report. Matt will talk to you next week, Jeff. Thanks again, and we'll come back for the second hour in a couple minutes. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in on the Matt McNeil Show this week. Matt's on vacation. And we got Brett on the board. He's on the board all week because Patrick's on vacation.
I know. Everyone's taking off spring break time.
Yeah. My wife is on vacation. I'm a bachelor right now. But I was still able to get her on April Fool's Day. I did it through photographs and texting. I got both her and my daughter, who's in,
oh really
my
oh,
daughter my daughter's in New York, and my wife. So I broke a headstock off a guitar like 2 months ago, and then I got it fixed, and I was told that it's now even stronger than it used to be. But I had a picture of the headstock laying on the floor. The headstock is the end where all the tuners are, you know. And it's a Les Paul, so it fell forward on its face, broke the headstock off. I got it fixed, and my daughter and my wife and everybody was all happy that my Les Paul was back, you know, on stage or whatever. And so then I just wrote. It came to me like in the evening. I just wrote and gave them the same picture, and I said, "Oh, it happened again! They told me it was never going to happen again because it's stronger." And then they both were like, "No!" And then I just told them to check their calendars for the date, and then they got mad. Well, my daughter never gets mad at me, but my wife does. My wife hates April Fools. My daughter loves April Fools.
Yeah, she must take after you then in that case. Yes.
A little bit, yeah. One time, my daughter and I went to a store and bought a baseball bat, and then we had a whole orchestrated thing where early in the morning – Eve, my daughter, had to set her alarm or, you know, make sure she woke up like before any of us were awake at like 5:30 or something. And she came screaming, running into our room saying, "There's a bat in my room! There's a bat in my room!" And then Heidi was all mad and like, "No way!" And we all get up and we go, and the bat was laying in the middle of the floor, and Heidi's looking up at the ceiling and she goes, "Where is it?" And I said, "There it is!" And I pointed at the bat. Baseball bat on the floor, and Heidi got really mad at both of us and went back to bed.
Yeah, you at least found it funny. Yeah, sounds like your wife did, though. Yeah.
Eve thought it was funny too. My wife thinks it's funny. It's just that she gets, you know, she had to go through a moment of thinking there was a bat in the house.
Yeah, which is not fun.
Right.
No,
I have told her I was gonna not do April Fools anymore, but I didn't think this one was that bad because it was my guitar and it wasn't like she wasn't involved. So I don't know. Yeah, rethinking it, I'm probably a horrible husband, but
hey, you've got now you've just set up the false sense of security for future April Fools.
You
said you're not going to do it anymore. Well, I guess this one kind of maybe messed it up, but I guess as you said, it only impacted you. So
yeah, are you an April Fools guy? Did you fool anybody?
No, I'm not much for April Fools stuff. Yeah. We did talk about doing this to Matt. If April Fools was on a Friday, we were going to at 3 o'clock. We were gonna play his theme music with the whole intro going, you know, like 5 minutes earlier than normal, just to kind of freak him out a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
Oh, supposed to go on right now?
Yeah.
But turn the light on. It was a Saturday. Yeah.
Yeah. I got fooled by the David Pakman April Fool's Day joke where he said his show was completely shutting down and his studio was being dismantled and everything. And he put a video up of it and said he's not going to have a show anymore. And I thought it was a bummer. And then on Monday, I thought, well, what's the development with that? And I looked and found out that it was an April Fool's. So I actually got fooled on April Fool's, which I don't know when the last time that's happened. I'm the fooler, not the foolee.
For David Pakman, he's got a very dry sense of humor. I can picture him doing that convincingly, just hearing him so often, obviously, in that 2 o'clock hour before we're on at 3. So I can see how he could fool a lot of people with that.
Yeah, it sounds like he did fool a lot of people. I was one of them. But I think it's funny. I was like, "Oh wow, you got me!" You know, I'm that guy. I'm going back to bed.
I like you said too. Like he went in like just a really kind of cruddy area of his house and filmed the background, saying, "Oh, they've torn down the studio. They're repossessing it," and just to add the effect to it. Yeah,
he acted it out pretty well too. So, talking about the weather, you did a weather report that just was basically today and tomorrow, but. Saturday, it's supposed to be 62 degrees. And by Tuesday and Wednesday, it's going to be like 72 degrees. So we're at that time of year here in Minnesota. It's always much better than January. I really have trouble with January and February. So, and March. And anyway.
How about April? Well, that depends every year.
Well, it depends. This April's getting pretty nice now. I mean, I wasn't too happy about it last Friday, but, you know. Say, what's our purpose here again? Oh, yeah, we talk about political things. Right. Because we're the progressive voice of Minnesota. By the way, if you have anything to add, 952-946-6205 is our phone number. Here is a new update. We were talking about with Jeff Stein that even if this case doesn't – if it doesn't come to a prosecution of Trump in this whole – you know, everybody's kind of calling it the Stormy Daniels case, but it really involves falsification of business records and some – for – which is against the law in the state of New York. It involves other things, but let's just call it this Stormy Daniels case for now. There are other cases coming up that may foreshadow or overshadow this case. That's kind of like what Jeff and I were saying. Even if this case doesn't lead to anything, there's going to be other cases, and this one might just be forgotten by the time we get actually, even to the end of April or maybe the end of this week. I don't know. You just never know. At any time, any of these other indictments might come in. Like Jeff said, this one also might have been thought of as, you know, he called it a conspiracy theory, which I guess it would be, sort of a sacrificial lamb. You know, maybe he called Fannie Willis and said, hey, how about I do my indictment? And then would you feel better about doing your indictment? And she's like, that'd be great. But, you know, are we supposed to talk about this? I don't know if that's illegal or not, and I certainly am not saying it happened. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure it did not happen. But, you know, like Jeff said, now that this indictment has happened and the arraignment has happened, it has happened. And so the other ones will be a little less of a shock to the public. But in one of them, this just in, former top national security officials have testified to a federal grand jury that they repeatedly told former President Donald Trump and his allies that the government did not have the authority to seize voting machines after the 2020 election. Chad Wolf, the former acting Homeland Security Secretary, and his former deputy, Ken Cuccinelli, were asked about discussions inside the administration around DHS seizing voting machines when they appeared before the grand jury earlier this year. This is according to three people familiar with the proceedings. Cuccinelli testified that he made clear at all times that DHS did not have the authority to take such a step. Trump's former national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, in a closed-door interview with federal prosecutors earlier this year, also recounted conversations about seizing voting machines after the 2020 election, including during a heated Oval Office meeting that Trump participated in. Details about the secret grand jury testimony and O'Brien's interview, neither of which have been previously reported, illustrate how Special Counsel Jack Smith and his prosecutors are looking at the various ways Trump tried to overturn his electoral loss, despite some of his top officials advising him against the ideas. Now, some of those same officials, including Wolf, Cuccinelli, and O'Brien, as well as others who have so far refused to testify, may have to return to the grand jury in Washington, D.C. to provide additional testimony after a series of pivotal court rulings that were revealed in recent weeks rejecting Trump's claims of executive privilege. Cuccinelli was spotted going back into the grand jury on Tuesday, April 4th, yesterday. Without that privilege shield, former officials must answer questions about their interactions and conversations with the former president, including what he was told about the lack of evidence for election fraud and the legal remedies he could pursue. That line of questioning goes to the heart of Smith's challenge in any criminal case he might bring to prove that Trump and his allies pursued their efforts despite knowing their fraud claims were false or their gambits weren't lawful. To bring any potential crime charges, prosecutors would have to overcome Trump's public claim that he believed then and now that fraud really did exist and cost him the election. There's lots of ways you can show that, but certainly one of them is if Biden knew that they were what they were talking about, that there was no basis to take the actions. So that's pretty important, and we're seeing, you know, Trump has been trying to delay, and it's just looking like all of his efforts are now exhausted. So all of these, you know, tactics are falling apart. This is a really, really important point to make in the case. It's a very pivotal point to make. You have to prove that Trump knew that he was lying. You know, Trump is trying to say, no, I really thought it was a... He can't use that defense anymore. And it sounds like these guys are being called back in to reiterate what they have done. It sounds like Jack Smith has a lot of things that he's kind of cleaning up and getting lined up in a presentable way. This would be, which case would this be? there are so many cases, so many things closing in on the Trump Meister. Drafting, this is a really new article. This information that I'm reading to you just came out today at about 1 o'clock our time. So I haven't had a chance to read this. So I'm not even sure what the content of this next part is. It's got a subtitle, Drafting Executive Orders. Inside the Trump White House after the 2020 election, the push to seize voting machines eventually led to executive orders being drafted in mid-December of that year, directing the military and the DHS to carry out the task, despite Wolf and Cuccinelli telling Trump that his allies, their agency did not have the authority to do so. Okay, so that's pretty substantive. I think that's a pretty big deal. Why don't we take a short break, come back, talk about it some more. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in on the Matt McNeil Show. We'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We're back on the Matt McNeil Show. I am not Matt McNeil. I'm Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt, who's on vacation. We got Brett on the board. And playing all the music, sometimes actually some of the instruments. We were talking about new developments in Trump troubles. It seems like some of these things might cross over into more than one indictment. But we were just talking about something, and this news just came out about a couple hours ago. And we were just finding out that inside the Trump White House after the 2020 election, the push to seize voting machines eventually led to executive orders being drafted in mid-December of 2020, directing the military and DHS to carry out the task of collecting voting machines. So those orders, which cited debunked claims about voting system irregularities in Michigan and Georgia, were presented to Trump by his former national security advisor, Mike Flynn, who's, you know, crazy QAnon, and then lawyer Sidney Powell, who's I don't know if she's QAnon, but she's crazy, during a now infamous Oval Office meeting on December 18th. Everybody was yelling at each other. It was a pretty raucous thing. But now this is coming out officially and it's being reported and putting into these indictments. Some of these stories, you know, I've read these in the various books that have been put out over the last 2 years. They're stunning books to read. But the fact that now people are testifying under oath that these stories are true and they're testifying to the special counsel is a pretty big deal. So Jack Smith's team has asked witnesses about that meeting in front of the grand jury and during closed-door interviews. Multiple sources have reported this. Among them was O'Brien, who told the January 6th House Select Committee that he was patched into the December 18 meeting by phone after it had already dipped into a screaming match between Flynn, Powell, and White House lawyers. O'Brien told the committee that at some point someone asked him if there was evidence of election fraud or foreign interference in the voting machines. And I said, no, we've looked into that, and there's no evidence of it. That's what O'Brien responded. Then he said, I was told we didn't have any evidence of any voter machine fraud in the 2020 election. When asked about that meeting by federal prosecutors working for Jack Smith, the special counsel, O'Brien reiterated that he made clear there was no evidence of foreign interference affecting voting machines. So this is more proof that Trump was being told that there was no evidence of interference by voting machines. Yet he was writing executive orders to have the military collect voting machines. This is dictatorship type of stuff. Now, O'Brien met with prosecutors earlier this year after receiving a subpoena from Smith's team and is among the Trump officials who could be called back to discuss conversations with Trump under the judge's recent decision in on executive privilege. So these guys are able to talk more because the judge ruled against Trump trying to claim executive privilege. Former Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe, who personally told allies of the former president that there was no evidence of foreign election interference or widespread fraud that would justify taking extreme steps like seizing voting machines, but also he must also testify, the judge decided. A spokesperson for Ratcliffe did not respond yet to CNN's request, at least, and Wolf also declined to comment. But that kind of doesn't really matter. Cuccinelli acknowledged to the January 6th committee last year that after the election, he was asked several times by Trump's then-attorney Rudy Giuliani and on at least one occasion by Trump himself if DHS had authority to seize voting machines. Wolf told the committee he was repeatedly asked the same question by then-White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Why would you repeatedly ask that question? I mean, is this legal? Does the DHS have the authority for this? And the DHS director says, no, we don't. And so the next day you're going to go ask him that question again, you know? Yeah. Anyway, Mark Meadows, not the brightest bulb in the knife drawer.
Clearly all, yeah, those are the actions of people who are not guilty.
Right.
Yeah, just repeatedly ask you, is this legal? Yeah.
I imagine with Mark Meadows, it's just, you know, he asks him and then Trump says, did you ask him? And he goes, yes. He said they don't have the authority. Ask him again, you know. So, but Mark Meadows has proven to be pretty dumb as well. But so who knows? Yeah. So things closing in. And we heard on the top of the hour national news report from AP that and I was thinking this a couple weeks ago, a tactic that Pence is doing. So, you know, Pence was subpoenaed to testify, and he said, I can't remember the name of what this is, but a ruling that he said, since I was the president of the Senate, I can't be compelled to testify under the clause, and it is something that protects so that, you know, in the Senate and the House, you need to be able to talk about things and in a wide variety of things, and you can't be held to certain sentences or something legally. I mean, you just because you're talking about maybe you're talking about illegal things. But that doesn't mean that what you're doing is illegal because you're trying to solve problems. Anyway, I don't know really how to explain it, as you can tell by my horrible explanation of it right there. But anyway, he was trying to make an argument that I'm not going to go in for the subpoena. Well, then they got back to him and said, okay, we won't make you talk about anything in your capacity of being president of the Senate. And then Pence went on some TV show, or he was at a, on a panel somewhere or something, and he said, I was very glad to hear that the that they ruled in my favor on that particular issue. And I think he said that purposefully. It might have even been at CPAC or something like that. I think he said it purposefully so that he was giving himself room to actually go in and testify, because I think he wants to testify. And now we just heard the news that must have just came out a few minutes ago that he is going to testify. He's not going to fight the subpoena, which I guess means he's going to testify. And I think he wants to testify. I think he wants to bring Trump down like probably 99% of the Republicans do. And, you know, but he's trying to find ways of, and like we, like I said the other day too, either yesterday or Monday, he's saying that this current Stormy Daniels, you know, whole arraignment and everything is an outrage. I think he's going against the paying the porn star thing, but then when something like the classified documents case comes through and there's an indictment on that, I think Pence will say, okay, yeah, this is too much. I can no longer defend Trump because I need to at some point choose country over Trump. Because he needs to get rid of Trump if he's going to run for president. And he also needs to defend Trump as long as possible to try and get the support of Trump supporters. That's what he's trying to navigate. That's what I think. Anyway, so we'll bring it back to some Minnesota issues when we come back after a short break. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in on the Matt McNeil Show. We'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson in for the Matt McNeil Show. Brett on the board. You could be on the air if you call 952-946-6205. First caller gets on the air. So we're moving things back to Minnesota issues. And there are a lot of really great things going on in Minnesota politics. And we're going to have – we've been having trouble getting guests this week because everybody's on vacation, including the state legislature. But I pressured her enough to call in from her vacation. We're going to – if everything goes as planned, we're going to have Senator Kelly Morrison, my senator. First time I've had a senator, a DFL, a Democrat state senator, Democratic state senator in most of – so I've lived in the place I live now for probably three quarters of my life, and I have never had a Democratic state senator or House member represent me out in that area ever, because Kelly Morrison is the first DFLer to ever win an election in the whole area. And she's going to call in and give us some perspectives on some things. She's written and passed a lot of bills. And she's, I think, the hardest working legislator. And she's still going to take the time out of her vacation to call in and tell us all what's going on down there. And if everything goes as planned as well, on Friday, Representative Cedric Frazier is going to be live here in the studio. And so we can get a lot of updates from him, too, about the good things going on in Minnesota politics. Sadly, a big part of Minnesota politics is the cheating of the Minnesota Republican Party, both at the national level and in Minnesota. The Republican Party knows that they cannot win without cheating. They have tried their hardest to gerrymander. It's a little more difficult to do so in Minnesota because it eventually goes to somebody else, because the legislature can never agree on the lines, so it goes to a court and they decide the final line. So it's more difficult for Republicans to gerrymander in Minnesota than it is to do so in, say, Wisconsin or Georgia or somebody someplace like that. But they still try and do it, and then they do other shenanigans. Now, I'm going to tell a couple stories here, and the first one I'll be reading from the Minnesota Reformer, one of our favorite journalistic outlets. They really, really do an incredible job. MinnesotaReformer.com. Just go there and browse around, and you'll find really, really valuable information, well written. So the first story here is just even within Minneapolis. Now, the Republican Party knows they can't win anything in Minneapolis or St. Paul, or really now in Hennepin or Ramsey County, because they have pretty much lost the suburbs as well. Hence, Kelly Morrison getting elected way out in the outer – we're kind of in the outer ring suburbs, and we're taking it over. We've been bringing the numbers up and up and turning it blue. So now the Republicans, this is evidence of trying to infiltrate in Minneapolis. And I think this story is pretty unbelievable. and it just came out today, this morning. So it's brand new news as well. The chair of the Minneapolis Democratic Farmer Labor Party has been granted a temporary restraining order against Minneapolis City Council candidate Victor Martinez. Minneapolis DFL Chair Brianna Rose Lee, a volunteer who is planning the caucuses and conventions for the 3rd Ward City Council election, was granted the harassment restraining order on Monday. A judge ordered Martinez not to have any contact with Lee and to stay at least 1/4 mile from her home for 2 years. The move comes 1 week after the Minneapolis DFL Executive Committee voted not to accept hundreds of delegate signups for Martinez because of suspected malfeasance. Martinez's campaign signed up 358 out of 514 of his delegates using the same IP address and could not validate them with paper sign-up forms, saying the forms had been thrown out. So he's trying to win a seat. You need delegates. And 3/5 of them, he didn't even keep the sign-up forms. He threw them out. I mean, you know, it's not like he had the forms laying around his house for 2 years and thought, oh, I don't need these anymore. He needs them still because he's trying to get the endorsement of the party. And he's doing it by cheating. 358 out of 514 of his delegates I'm going to repeat the whole thing. His campaign signed up 358 out of 514 of his delegates using the same IP address and could not validate them with paper sign-up forms, saying the forms had been thrown out. Okay, so that's a huge lie, and it's obvious, and he's either an idiot for thinking he could get away with it, or he's just a piece of crap for doing it, and both could be true as well. I don't know. So this guy, Martinez, he is an Assembly of God pastor who opposes abortion rights and was endorsed by the Minneapolis Police Union. Yet he's seeking the DFL endorsement for Ward 5's city council seat. Now, the guy currently sitting in or is running against him is a progressive guy, and he is a city council member, Jeremiah Ellison, and he's a known progressive. Most of them are on the Minneapolis City Council, but the Republicans are trying to get somebody on the city council. So they say, just falsely sign up delegates, and if they hassle you, just tell them that you accidentally threw the forms away. He opposes abortion, and he's trying to get endorsed by the DFL Minneapolis City Council. In her request, the chair, Ms. Lee, wrote, "Victor cheated and tried to stuff the virtual ballot box. I caught him, and now he is lashing out and doxed me." Lee said he emailed supporters and publicized her phone number and email so they would call and harass her over a decision she made that he didn't like. She wrote that she received about 40 angry voicemails and numerous emails. One of Martinez's supporters threatened her on Facebook, saying he picked out a coffin for her, and posted blueprints of her friend's house on Twitter. Lee alleged, well, this is what Lee is alleging, but obviously it was found that it's true because she was granted the restraining order. I mean, one of his supporters threatened her on Facebook, saying he picked out a coffin for her and posted blueprints of her friend's house on Twitter. "Victor sent a dangerous person after me," Lee also wrote. She said she's afraid to go any place. She might be recognized and can't answer the phone anymore. "I have no privacy," she wrote. In an interview, Martinez said he was served with the restraining order Tuesday and was shocked and dismayed. "I can't believe she would do this. I've never once called her names. I never once was disrespectful to her at all. Quite the opposite." Martinez said he went public with his concerns, alerting his supporters because Lee wouldn't respond to his phone calls. As for the supporter who threatened Lee, Martinez said he talked to the man and "I never told him to say anything like that to her. I have no idea about these things." The Minneapolis DFL Executive Committee met again Monday, but Lee did not attend because Martinez was invited to join virtually to defend his delegate signups. After hearing from both campaigns, the committee reaffirmed its decision to toss Martinez's delegates. Martinez could still bring all of his nearly 500 claimed delegates to the local convention for a credentials challenge, allowing the credentials committee and convention as a whole to vote on whether to seat the additional delegates. Martinez was skeptical of that route and said he's going to appeal to the state DFL party. Yeah, you know why he's skeptical of that route? Because he can't do it. He can't provide proof of the delegates being real. So then he says, "We believe the Minneapolis DFL is working in favor of Ellison, his opponent. We don't believe we had a fair hearing." So that's what they do. They cheat. They get caught cheating, and then they say that the other side is cheating. That's what the Republican Party does, and that's all the Republican Party does. He'll also be fighting against the restraining order. He has 20 days to request a hearing to try to convince the judge to change or vacate the order, and intends to seek one. Lee would have to show up and prove the statements in her petition are true, and that she was harassed. And that's why he wants to do it, because he wants to scare her more. He wants to make her go in a room with him. Yeah, he says, "I'm pretty confident it won't hold up. I would never purposefully try to hurt anybody, and if I've ever made Brianna feel threatened, then I am sorry about that." Yeah. Tell your story walking, buddy. We don't believe a word of it. Get the frig out. He will continue to seek the endorsement while having no contact with the head of the local DFL. So how do you do that? How do you even do that? How can you do that? I don't know how you could do that. I mean, I know how this stuff works, and it's not going to work. I don't know why he's still trying. That's one story. Recent information, more updated, has come out about the whole GOP helped pro-pot candidates. A bevy of less than groovy Republicans made a flurry of donations to a pot party candidate last summer. This is another story from the Minnesota Reformer. The donations came days before a July deadline for Tim Davis of the Legal Marijuana Now party to raise enough money to get a public subsidy for his state auditor campaign, giving him a cash infusion to potentially pull votes from DFL state auditor Julie Blaha. So, I'll explain more about the ins and outs of this story when we come back from a break. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil. We'll be right back. A screaming comes. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in on the Matt McNeil Show. Brett on the board and on the guitar. So we were talking about this pot party story. Pot party.
The pot party story. Yeah.
It's not a story about a party where we smoke pot. It's about a political party. And we're telling the story of the state auditor's election. And what happened in 2022, Julie Blaha was the Democrat. She was narrowly reelected in November of 2022 over Republican Ryan Wilson. Blaha beat Wilson by only 8,400 votes. But the pot candidate, his name Tim Davis, he pulled in 87,000 votes. Now, do you think those 87,000 votes were tight-ass Republicans? Probably not. They were probably people who are in favor of legalizing marijuana. Representative Mary Franzen from Alexandria, she's a Republican, donated $50 to Davis, even though she voted against the legalizing medicinal marijuana in 2014. Even medicinal marijuana she voted against. She's opposed legalizing recreational marijuana forever. She has a 0% rating by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws and recently told constituents in an email, there will be many public health and safety issues if Minnesota legalizes recreational marijuana. She's very much against it, but she donated to the candidate for the Legal Marijuana Now party. There's a couple different ones that basically Republicans got up and running. Now, there's a deadline in July of election years in Minnesota where if you have raised a certain amount of money for your campaign, you then can get the public subsidy. So Republicans made sure that this guy made enough money in his campaign to receive the public subsidy. And since it's a statewide office, it's a buttload of money. He got $29,000 of your and my money, and he spent it to hire a guy to door knock. I'm really skipping around here. He hired a GOP activist. He hired Paul Tucci, a.k.a. Liberty Longbeard, a former GOP state House candidate and 2020 campaign advisor to the late Adam Weeks, who was a Legal Marijuana Now candidate in the 2nd District with close ties to Republicans. Now, he basically, that marijuana party, cheated enough to win a congressional seat for 2 years down in District 2. Took away enough votes from the Democratic Party to make the Republican win a congressional seat. Now, we won it back 2 years later. But, you know, our eyes are open now. So he hired this guy and he paid this guy $26,000 to go door knocking for Davis. So basically, he's leaving, you know, either knocking on people's doors and telling them about, you know, the legalized marijuana now party, or leaving a piece of literature. So, of course, there's a lot of people who are just like, oh, dude, I'm totally voting for this dude, you know? And it's siphoning votes away from the Democratic candidate is all it's doing. There's a lot of, you know, all of this information is wide open. So there's other Republicans that have contributed to this. DFL chair Ken Martin said after numerous instances of manipulation of third parties in 2020, bad actors, as he called them, did it again last year. They really did it in 2020 pretty badly. I think they did it in 2018 as well. Yeah, because that's when Angie Craig lost in District 2 by less of a margin than what the pot party person got. Basically proof. Now, Paul Gazelka, who was the former leader of the Senate, the GOP leader in the Senate, he gave a bunch of money to one of these illegitimate candidates, and they are, I mean, literally illegitimate candidates. This has become enough of a problem that the legislature is now considering a bill to make it harder for alternative parties to attain major party status. Major party status, which the two pot parties attained with strong showings in 2018, means automatic ballot access, meaning anyone can sign up to be a candidate for one of those parties, which is what makes them vulnerable to chicanery. But the alternative parties say the proposal amounts to Democrats and Republicans limiting voters' choices to an unappealing duopoly. Now, this guy, I'm looking at his picture, this guy Tim Davis, he looks like he's probably in about 70 or older, and he looks like Santa Claus with 1970s glasses. Do you think he was planning on becoming the Minnesota State Auditor? Do you think he was running to win?
That'd be really weird if you're in your office and, well, the State Auditor's coming in today and you see that guy.
I know. The other things he ran on, one of the other things was green energy. But the Republicans gave him money. He got no money from Democrats, and the only money he got was from Republicans and the public subsidy. It's just vile. It's disgusting what they do because they know they cannot win. So they cheat. They try and find a candidate that they know will take votes away from the Democrat. They know they won't get enough votes to win, but they will take enough votes away from the Democrat to possibly make the Democrat lose the election. So we're hoping that we're overwhelming that with our incredible voter turnout, and I believe we are. Todd Mickelson sitting in on the Matt McNeil Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Please listen to my podcast, A Satellite View. You can find it at the AM950 website. Go to AM950radio.com. Go to the AM Radio 950 Radio programs page, and you can find my podcast there. All right. We will talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening today, and thanks, Wisconsin.